Let's talk about what is happening with women in combat now in general.
Well, the roles of women in combat have changed dramatically since the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan started. Women are not only being attached to combat arms units on a daily basis in the form of female engagement teams, but they're also on convoys regularly that are exposed to improvised explosive devices, roadside bombs. Women and non-infantry, non-combat arms personnel in general are exposed to hostile fire on kind of daily tasks. You know, women prior to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had not seen this kind of exposure, just a little bit during the Gulf War, but not in this concerted effort to integrate women into sort of the daily lives of local people in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. military really saw an opportunity to integrate women at that level to gain more access to local villagers, to village elders, to women who offer a completely different perspective on the ground in villages than their husbands do. And so there's really been an opportunity not only to learn more kind of culturally about the people in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in terms of career progression for women in the military. There's never been anything like this. You know, your average lieutenant is being exposed, female lieutenant is being exposed to combat at an extraordinary rate. Enlisted Marines and soldiers are being exposed to combat every day. It's quite phenomenal.
Okay. Is it actually legal now for the women to be in combat?
Well, the combat exclusion policy prohibits assignment to these all-male combat arms units, below the brigade level, technically speaking. And so the way the military gets around that is to attach women to these units instead of assigning them to these units. Now, it's not a law. It's a policy that was left over from the days of Les Aspin, who served under Clinton. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a bad habit that has never been changed. So DOD can change this on its own. You know, the new Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, can change this. I mean, there's been an overwhelming sense of support for these changes. The question becomes, how exactly do those changes happen? You know, what we'd like to see is that women get the opportunity to try out for any of these roles. You know, if she's qualified to do it, she should be able to do it. I think job requirements need to be defined accordingly. I think the military has started catching up with the idea that, you know, 50-mile forced marches may not be necessary in today's day and age and in your average kind of training environment, but other types of physical requirements may be more appropriate. And I've met some amazing women in my time in the military, and those that are still in, many of them are capable of doing what the infantry do. I'm certainly capable of doing what, you know, artillerymen and tankers do. I know a bunch of women who want to try special forces. There's no reason that they shouldn't be allowed to try Ranger School and to go through BUDS and Navy SEAL training. I mean, it's just un-American not to allow anyone who wants to serve in uniform to try, you know, sort of test her mettle, to not allow her to do that.
Mm-hmm. So women are actually in danger, but they're not getting the credit for having served that way.
Exactly. Well, we're seeing a bunch of things happen as a result of this kind of paradox. One is that occasionally women who are in these kind of special situations, you know, they're exposed to hostile fire, taking the same fires as their male counterparts, are not being given the awards and commendations for technical reasons, either because their commanders are so uneducated that they don't realize, you know, that they're, you know, these women were exposed in the same firefight to the same fire. Or there's just plain bias. You know, well, the policy says you can't be assigned to these units, even though you weren't technically assigned, because you're a woman, we're not going to give you, you know, the combat badge or the medal that the entire rest of the unit got. You know, the rest of them were men. I mean, it's just absurd. And the other kind of way in which you're seeing bias play out is on the VA, the veteran side of things. If you have post-traumatic stress or depression or anxiety, you know, it's really common conditions associated with combat trauma, and you're a woman in one of these sort of special units, you know, assigned to a very specific mission where you were exposed to hostile fire, or even if you were one of the sort of the women who were not in a FET team or a Lioness team, but were, you know, during a deployment on a convoy that was exposed to a roadside bomb, an IED, this type of thing, you may sort of be left out of the picture as you're applying for veterans benefits to prove that, you know, your depression originated because you were in such and such a place with, you know, an all-male unit or, you know, in an integrated capacity. But the education on women in combat still hasn't quite filtered down to all the people, all the institutions that are helping veterans either. So everyone who's working for VA needs to understand that women are in combat today, and they need to be treated accordingly.
Mm-hmm. It used to be, I think, that men didn't want to have women in their charge, and they said, no, not in my unit or something like that. But you sound as though now they are looking for women to do special jobs.
Yeah, you'll still find that sentiment, I think, military-wide. There will always be biased commanders who don't understand, have never worked with women, or just, you know, don't want women to succeed. But the fact of the matter is, in the combat arms community, you know, and among commanders, there's the recognition that male infantrymen cannot do the work that women in the military can do. They're just not allowed access. They cannot gain the intelligence that's required to complete missions in Afghanistan. And therefore, the infantry, for the first time, you know, really is having to adjust and work with women in the Marine Corps, and Special Forces is doing the same thing with women. I mean, it's quite phenomenal. And so there's an entire shift in mindset that's happening right now. And it's, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. Military culture doesn't shift overnight, but it's an extraordinary opportunity to educate our men in the military about what women can do and, you know, the talents and capabilities of women on the battlefield.
You were in the Marines?
I was in the Marines. I was a captain when I got out after 5 years.
And tell me about women in the Marines. I've mostly done interviews about women in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Women in the Marines, like men in the Marines, are probably a special breed. It's the branch with the fewest percentage of women in it. Only about 6% of the Marine Corps is female. I was an officer, and the pressure on women leaders is enormous in the Marine Corps. You know, there's oftentimes a sense that, you know, they want to see you fail, you know, that you can't do the job, that you're not as physically fit. All of these kind of stereotypes. And, you know, you can beat a lot of them just by working twice as hard, But, you know, again, culture does not change overnight, and so the hostility is definitely palpable. It can really affect you. You know, the longer you stay in, I think the tougher you get. There are some great men in the Marine Corps who I think, you know, have just been raised by really great moms and dads who don't treat women like they're second-class citizens, and are fully willing to embrace the idea that women should be given, you know, every opportunity they're capable of meeting. So, you know, I face a lot of challenges, but women in the Marine Corps are amazing, very talented. You know, I know Cobra pilots, you know, these are fighter pilots who are women, you know, women who are joining FET teams, female engagement teams, are just extraordinary. Women want to be on the front lines oftentimes, and, you know, we should give them every opportunity to do that.
What was your goal when you joined the Marines? What did you want to happen?
I mean, I joined the Marines because they were the toughest branch, because I wanted a good challenge. I think every assignment I sought out was one which was challenging. Oftentimes what I did, what I chose to do, very few, if any, women had done before. So it was always kind of, I was always kind of pushing the envelope and testing the limits, really, of Marine Corps policy. You know, I wanted to be a human intelligence officer, but at that time, back in 2000, I couldn't be a human intelligence officer. It was off limits to women, and that job position actually just opened up last year to women in the Marines, which is amazing. Really a huge victory. Really, there was no good reason to keep them out of human intelligence. But I know some folks who work in human intelligence right now in the Marines who say, you know, that integration has been difficult for women because it's such a sexist community. Oh. That, you know, they have not welcomed women the way we would hope they would. So,
how long were you in the Marines?
for 5 years. I was in 5 years.
Okay. And talk to me about what you're doing now, the organization that you started.
So I helped found Service Women's Action Network, and it's an advocacy organization that does both policy work as well as litigation, and we offer a national peer support helpline for women veterans, for service women, and for men who have been affected by the issues we deal with. And they're all equal opportunity issues that range from the job discrimination that women face in combat through the combat exclusion policy to the sexual violence and domestic violence that many women face to, you know, reproductive rights, LGBT rights, and the challenges women face in navigating VA, Veterans Affairs, on both the healthcare and the benefits side.
And how many people do you serve? What kind of call do you have?
Well, our helpline serves hundreds every year. We're not a traditional veterans service organization, a VSO, which historically, you know, like these gigantic organizations like the American Legion or Veterans of Foreign Wars, we decided to kind of organize in a different way. So have a client base and advocate at a national level in terms of policy changes.
And why did you end up leaving the Marines?
I left in 2004 largely because of discrimination and sexual harassment. I had been in 5 years, and I just wanted to be treated better. And every unit I went to, every training facility I had been at, really was not offering much of a better situation than the last one I'd been to. So I thought, you know, it was very difficult because I loved it and I love it. But there, you know, at that time I thought, you know, maybe I can do something else. And certainly I'm helping women in the military more on the outside than I was on the inside. I tried my best, especially as a junior officer, company commander, to help women who are being harmed and who are not getting support from senior commanders, and it didn't work. And that was one of my biggest lessons, is the military has policies on paper that are consistently not enforced by local commanders, so what good are they? Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Is there any chance that you go back? Has things changed enough for you to go back?
Definitely. I kind of hunger to be back in uniform. Anyway, not only was the job that I wanted now open to women, but just the things happening overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq are extraordinary. I mean, I'm really proud of what women are doing. I would love to be part of that again. I'm very injured because of some of the things that I did in the Marine Corps and some of the, you know, the harassment from the Marines. You know, that definitely still weighs on me. So if I can get my body back in sort of fighting condition, I might consider it.
So do you mean that you're physically injured or mentally injured?
Well, both. You know, the harassment left me with depression and PTSD, and the physical work, you know, the black belt school I went through and all that training left me with multiple knee injuries, shoulder injuries. So, you know, I'm 36. I'm not that old by Marine standards, but my body is much older than it should be for a 36-year-old.
I was surprised when you said that one of the kind of hidden, or one of the secrets of the military, is that there is many men who are victims of sexual, well, of rape than as women.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. The VA treats almost as many male survivors of military sexual trauma as women. So the patient population in VA that's being treated for sexual assault or sexual harassment is very diverse gender-wise. It's something that the VA understands, but DOD still sort of looks at this as a women's issue, and society at large still looks at it as a women's issue. And I think that's problematic, first of all, because we're clearly not welcoming men who need our support. We're not understanding the gender dynamics within the military. Our lens is just all wrong. You know, before women were in the military in large numbers, men made up most of the victims of sexual assault. So we really need to widen our perspective.
And do you think that with Don't Ask, Don't Tell going away, that that'll change?
I think with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the military has an opportunity to shift the culture enough with consistent messaging such that women and men are not abused quite as much as they are today. I think by creating a more tolerant atmosphere, women might benefit. What worries me about the repeal is that not enough was done. So what you have is gay and lesbian service members can openly serve, but they were not included as a protected class in equal opportunity policy. And it's a little bit like recognizing that people of color might be targeted under, you know, for hate crimes without providing legal protections for them in the judicial system. So it's, you know, we'll see how that element of things pans out. But I think definitely the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell will, over time, create a more tolerant military for everyone.
And talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell having been used against women who weren't necessarily gay.
When Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place, lesbian baiting was a common feature of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And even before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, before the 90s, homophobia was rampant. I mean, there were witch hunts and just horrible investigations of women who were perceived to be gay, you know, who were accused of being gay, as well as the men. But the women have often faced kind of the double whammy of gender discrimination and sexual harassment combined with homophobia. The concept of being of perceptions about sexuality or sexual orientation are really important to understand in the military, because if you're acting like too much of a man, you know, which the military would define in very kind of narrow terms, right? Like your hair might be too short, you might be too tough, you know, you don't talk about a man, you don't talk about your boyfriend, or you know you're not married, you know, your private life is not exposed in that way. People start gossiping, and people who don't want you there can use it against you, right? So if you don't play a sort of feminine stereotype, you'll be accused of being gay. It happens every day. Same thing happens with men, slightly different way. You know, if you're accused of being too kind, too nice, too feminine, however the military wants to define feminine, you are also perceived to be gay potentially. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell was used to kick qualified service members out, and there were a few straight members that we know of that were punished for a variety of reasons, sometimes in retaliation for sexual assault. But I think the most important thing is that all women were vulnerable under that policy.
So with the change in policy, does that mean it'll just go underground, or that there'll be a real change?
I think there already is a real change in the sense that lots of service members have come out of the closet without facing harassment. But, you know, they obviously chose to do that by assessing the level of threat against them in the command that they were assigned to currently, right? So, you know, gay and lesbian service members are not naive. I mean, homophobia still exists in the military. It won't disappear overnight. And most people will assess, you know, am I safe? You know, can I come out to everybody in this unit, or maybe just a couple of people? Can I come out to my chain of command, or can they use it against me, you know, in terms of promotion and assignment? And they'll determine that case by case.
Okay. Do you have a blog, or do you have places where you write that people can get your ideas?
They can go to our website at www.servicewomen.org, and there's a lot of information about what we do on there.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.